So this submitted material is a rigorous theoretical framework outlining the political ethics of civilizational healing, specifically navigating how societies can legitimately constrain harmful mechanisms and repair systemic injuries when consensual harmony is impossible. But the sheer density of discrete frameworks and diagnostic tests threatens to overwhelm the core ethical argument of the manuscript.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, the material is intellectually formidable, don't get me wrong.
Oh, absolutely.
But we are introduced to just a truly impressive array of tools, like you have the 8-dimensional conflict taxonomy, the 20-question legitimate constraint test.
The least dominating effective means principle, which is a mouthful on its own.
Right. And then add in the dual error governance criteria, the two-axis repair architecture, and the 7-pathway responsibility architecture.
It's just a massive undertaking.
It really is. But by presenting these as distinct, heavily structured lists and matrices, the reader is kind of forced to juggle too many separate mental models at once.
Yeah, it felt like I needed a separate PhD just to keep track of the acronyms by page 40. It's a huge administrative heavy lift for the reader.
Exactly.
And the overarching philosophical narrative here is actually this profound argument for protecting plural agency while ending domination. But that narrative gets completely bogged down in the sheer administrative weight of what essentially becomes this, like, 15-dimensional conflict constraint repair matrix.
Which just completely stalls the underlying momentum of the ethical argument.
Right.
When a reader has to constantly flip back to reference different acronyms and numbered lists, they lose the thread of the actual stakes. So the suggestion here is to consolidate these overlapping tools into a single sequential pathway.
Okay, yeah.
The manuscript should explicitly map how the outputs of one phase organically become the inputs for the next, rather than presenting them as parallel tracks that the reader just has to synthesize on their own.
Reading this right now feels a bit like stepping into a pilot's cockpit that has, you know, 15 separate, totally unintegrated dashboards.
Yes, that's a great way to put it.
You've got an altitude dial over here, a fuel gauge behind you, and a weather radar by your knee. What the reader actually needs is a unified heads-up display where all this critical data is projected onto the single pane of glass they're looking through.
Exactly.
So if we are streamlining this, how exactly do we merge these tools without losing the theoretical rigor? I mean, for instance, could the legitimate constraint test and the dual error governance modules essentially be combined?
They absolutely have to be combined. I mean, let's look at the mechanics of the dual error governance framework. It evaluates severity, uncertainty, urgency, reversibility, and the distribution of error costs.
Which means false positives versus false negatives, right?
Right, exactly. But right now, this is treated as a separate conceptual rail from the contestation adequacy and necessity modules that are found in the legitimate constraint test.
Gotcha.
But in reality, you cannot answer the 20 questions in the legitimate constraint test without already doing the dual error analysis.
Because evaluating the necessity of a constraint inherently requires you to weigh the cost of being wrong.
Exactly. If you constrain a group unjustly, that's a false positive harm.
Right.
If you fail to constrain a truly harmful mechanism, letting the injury just continue, that's a false negative. If we embed those specific questions about false positive and false negative harms directly into the necessity module of the constraint test,
then the reader doesn't have to learn two separate frameworks.
Exactly. They just follow one logical flow of reasoning. It's kind of like trying to prescribe a high-risk medication. You wouldn't separate the diagnostic criteria from the side effect profile. They're the same conversation.
So let's apply that streamlined flow to the historical cases the author brings up, because right now those are fragmented across all the different tools to prove individual, isolated points.
Yeah, they're scattered everywhere.
We could use a single through-line case study, like the Minamata disease crisis or the Little Rock integration, and just walk it chronologically through the entire unified matrix.
Oh, that would anchor the abstraction perfectly. Imagine taking the Minamata crisis, where industrial wastewater poisoned a local Japanese population with mercury, and starting the manuscript with the initial epistemic and rights conflict.
Okay, yeah.
We explore the delayed causal recognition of the toxic discharge and the corporate denial. Then rather than jumping to a completely new historical case to explain the next tool, we walk that exact same Minamata event through the legitimate constraint test.
Showing exactly how the state failed its dual error assessment by allowing the harm to continue despite the uncertainty.
Right.
Which obviously resulted in a massive false negative error cost for the victims.
Precisely. And then we walk that same Minamata case all the way down into the structural and generative repair depth.
Oh, I see.
We look at the sediment dredging of the bay and the highly contested medical certification processes for the victims. We use that one historical narrative as a continuous anchor.
So the reader implicitly learns the architecture by watching it operate on a single, tangible crisis from start to finish.
Exactly. Without feeling like they are memorizing a textbook.
That makes so much sense. And, you know, once you consolidate this dashboard and walk the reader through a continuous reality like Minamata, the very first boundary a policymaker is going to stumble on is the anti-pathologization principle.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is conceptually beautiful, but it lacks a practical diagnostic boundary for messy, borderline cases.
This section is arguably the moral heartbeat of the text, honestly. The material powerfully establishes eugenics and Nazi racial hygiene as a negative constitutional control.
It's very striking.
It is. It proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that human beings must never be classified as a contaminant, a virus, or a disease. The proposed rule is that interventions must target conduct, institutional function, or a demonstrable causal mechanism.
Right, which is a really elegant philosophical boundary. But in modern political conflicts, the line between a group's identity and their ideological conduct is incredibly blurry.
It's super murky.
The manuscript briefly asks if harmful collective ideologies can be constrained, but the four operational questions provided to separate mechanism from identity feel way too abstract.
They really do.
I mean, a bad faith state actor isn't going to just announce they're suppressing an identity. They are simply going to relabel an opposing identity group as a causal mechanism of harm to justify suppression.
And the framework, as currently written, doesn't give us a hard enough tool to stop them from doing that.
Right. So let's look closely at the section discussing the rights floor. Under this floor, the text allows for the constraint of ideologies that explicitly deny equal standing.
Yes.
But is there a risk that focusing solely on whether a person can, quote, leave the organization might overlook structural exclusions where leaving is socially or economically impossible?
That's a great point.
Like, if a state defines a marginalized religious or cultural group's core practices as a causal mechanism of harm, the fact that a person could theoretically abandon their faith or their community doesn't make the state's intervention any less pathologizing.
That is a vital pushback right there. It highlights exactly where the framework needs hardening. The abstraction fails when it hits real-world power dynamics.
So what's the fix?
We need to strengthen these boundary conditions by introducing a linguistic or rhetorical stress test specifically designed to expose when state or institutional power is using mechanism-directed language as a disguise for identity-based purification.
Okay.
We have to give the reader a tool to detect the actual shift in rhetoric.
And what does that linguistic stress test look like mechanically?
Well, you fix this by introducing a reciprocity test to the framework. If the targeted dissenting group flips the state's exact justification back onto the state, would it still describe a verifiable causal action, or would it just be an ad hominem attack?
Interesting.
Let's say a state claims a minority political faction is infecting the national discourse. If you flip that, and the faction says the state is infecting the discourse, neither side is describing a demonstrable causal mechanism.
They're just trading pathology metaphors.
Exactly. The reciprocity test forces the governing body to articulate a constraint that relies on verbs.
Like actions, policies, documented resource flows.
Yes, rather than adjectives and nouns describing the people themselves.
That makes a ton of sense. That forces the state to prove a mechanism rather than just declare a contagion.
Exactly. And to really anchor this, the manuscript needs to expand on the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, Article 5.3 case, which it actually already briefly mentions.
Oh, right, the tobacco one.
Yeah. Dive deep into how regulators successfully targeted the documented commercial conflict of interest of the tobacco industry. That conflict of interest is the conduct and the institutional function.
Right.
The guidelines limit lobbying interactions to what is strictly necessary. But crucially, the WHO doesn't declare tobacco executives to be a biological contagion. They regulate the verbs.
The funding, the lobbying, the access.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So then you contrast that directly with a modern misuse of public health language. For instance, when authorities use epidemiological metaphors, words like quarantine, virus, or infestation to exclude marginalized migrant groups.
Yes. By placing the legitimate WHO constraint side by side with the rhetorical public health abuse against migrants, the manuscript demonstrates exactly where the rhetorical shift occurs.
I see.
You show the reader how a state moves from targeting a mechanism, like lobbying access, to purifying an identity by turning humans into a metaphorical blight.
That's powerful.
It moves the anti-pathologization principle from a lofty moral aspiration to a hard operational legal test based on language.
Okay, so if we secure that boundary and the anti-pathologization principle holds, these groups still have to actually live together after the dust settles.
They do.
And here's where the framework almost trips over its own ideals. The strict insistence on non-compulsory reconciliation risks undermining the practical collaborative requirements necessary for regenerative repair.
This is perhaps the most nuanced tension in the entire manuscript. The material brilliantly separates justice from personal affect.
Right, drawing on the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Canadian residential schools.
Exactly. The author argues that victims cannot be forced to forgive or perform unity in order to receive reparations. It's a profound and necessary insight.
Because forced forgiveness is just another form of domination.
Precisely. However, there is a deep mechanical tension between this principle and the regenerative depth outlined in the two-axis repair architecture.
Wait, but if regenerative repair requires durable affected party power to shape future conditions, that means they have to co-govern, right?
Yes, exactly.
They have to sit in a room, allocate budgets, draft bylaws, and make policy compromises with the very institutions that harmed them. Isn't that functionally forcing them into the exact collaborative reconciliation the author just said is not compulsory?
That is the exact paradox the reader will stumble on. How do you govern a shared future with someone you refuse to reconcile with?
It's essentially like a messy corporate merger following a very hostile, damaging takeover.
That's a great analogy.
You don't necessarily need the legacy departments to like each other, and you certainly can't mandate that the employees forgive past grievances. But at the end of the day, they still have to use the same accounting software.
Right. They have to govern the new entity together.
So how exactly does a marginalized group maintain protective refusal while simultaneously co-governing a new institution with their historical oppressors?
To resolve this, the manuscript needs to explicitly define the operational difference between affective reconciliation and functional cooperation.
Okay, unpack that.
Well, affective reconciliation is an undemandable emotional state. It's forgiveness, trust, or civic love. Functional cooperation is a necessary institutional action. It's sitting at a technical table and dividing a budget.
Oh, I see the distinction.
The manuscript must explain how a community can engage in the latter while actively and rightfully withholding the former.
Because right now the text blends the two, making it seem like any cooperation is a betrayal of refusal.
Exactly.
So what is a historical scenario where a group successfully separated those two tracks?
The manuscript should really look at the Quechua indigenous people of Sarayaku in Ecuador. This illustrates the tension beautifully.
Okay.
The state of Ecuador granted oil concessions on Sarayaku territory without their consent, resulting in massive human rights violations and leaving hazardous explosives buried in their land.
Wow.
The Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruled in favor of the Sarayaku. So now you have a situation where the hazardous explosives must be removed.
Which requires a state's technical apparatus and funding, so the indigenous group has to coordinate with the exact entity that violated them.
Precisely. And the manuscript should detail what this looks like on the ground. The Sarayaku have to legally co-manage ecological hazard removal and jurisdictional boundaries.
Which hits the structural and generative repair depth perfectly.
Exactly. They sit at the technical table with state officials to ensure the explosives are removed safely. That satisfies the requirement for functional cooperation.
Right.
But simultaneously, they explicitly maintain a stance of political refusal.
they state on the record that this technical cooperation does not constitute effective reconciliation, nor does it mean they endorse the state's overarching jurisdictional presumptions.
So they are sharing the accounting software without forgiving the hostile takeover.
Perfect way to frame it.
Showing this dual-track reality proves that non-compulsory reconciliation isn't just a theory, it's a livable political strategy. But I mean, it sounds incredibly tense to live through on a daily basis.
Oh, it is fiercely tense, and the manuscript should own that tension rather than smoothing it over.
How so?
Well, to do this, the author needs to refine the definition of lawful coexistence. Right now, the way it's framed in the text, coexistence sounds a bit too peaceful. It implies a settling of the waters.
Right, like everyone just getting along?
Yeah. The author should add a subsection explicitly stating that coexistence might include highly adversarial, legally combative co-governance.
So, like, continuous legal friction, frequent injunctions, intense bargaining.
Exactly. The text needs to establish that continuous friction is not a failure of regenerative repair. Rather, it is the successful symptom of plural agency operating under a non-dominating protective order.
I love that.
If two groups are fighting fiercely in a courtroom or filing endless regulatory motions against each other, rather than engaging in systemic violence or facing unilateral state domination, the repair architecture is actually working.
Wow, yeah.
Normalizing that friction as a permanent state of affairs will make the author's framework much more resilient to real-world application.
That reframing of friction as a feature rather than a bug is incredibly powerful. It changes the entire goal of civilizational repair from achieving harmony to achieving a fair fight.
Exactly.
Well, let's recap the main points of this critique. First, the manuscript needs to streamline the robust 15-dimensional architecture into a cohesive chronological narrative pathway.
Yeah, embedding the dual error governance into the constraint test.
And using a single through-line case study like Minamata, which will drastically reduce the cognitive load on the reader.
Right. And second, the author must harden the boundaries of the anti-pathologization principle.
Right, with the linguistic reciprocity test.
Yes, and contrasting the WHO tobacco regulations with public health abuses against migrants. So the text closes the rhetorical loopholes that bad faith state actors might exploit to disguise identity purification as mechanism constraint.
And finally, clarifying the paradox of non-compulsory reconciliation.
Right, by explicitly distinguishing between affective reconciliation and functional cooperation.
And redefining lawful coexistence to include adversarial, legally combative co-governance. The framework proves that marginalized groups can engage in regenerative repair without being forced into emotional forgiveness.
The analytical depth of this material is truly exceptional. The author is tackling the exact point where political philosophy usually gives up and just tells everyone to get along.
Yeah, which never works.
Never. By leaning into these operational clarifications and owning the necessary friction of coexistence, this manuscript can become an indispensable field guide for navigating irreconcilable harm.
We would absolutely love to see how these concepts evolve. Please submit your revised work back in again for more feedback. We started this critique by looking at the sheer density of the mechanics of healing, but what this manuscript ultimately reveals is that a civilization doesn't have a single immune system, and it certainly doesn't share a single mind.
Beautifully said.
Healing a fractured society isn't about perfectly erasing the scar. It's about building a framework strong enough to let the scar exist without ever reopening the wound.